Hi.
Hi. So, what's this book about?
You didn't read this one either?
Well, I was gonna, but I accidentally read something else.
What?
Vogue.
I hated the book, all right? I have no idea what it's about, and the writer was clearly on drugs when he wrote it. I mean, it went on and on and on like it was written in a total hurry. If I handed in something like this, there's no way I'd get a good grade on it. I mean, it's boring and it's unorganized. And I only read 30 pages of it anyway.
Well, that was passionate, albeit entirely misinformed.
Who dares follow Miss Kelly's lucid analysis?
It's required reading.
With Tom and Stella.
Episode number 109, Good Spirits by B.K. Borison. Hello and welcome to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, a podcast brought to you by the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, and happy holidays. This podcast is all about books and literature, and each month we take a thorough look at one piece of literature that we've both read and determine whether it is required reading. And in this case, it's in order to get our spirits back up, because we sure did have a couple downers in a row. So let's see if I chose one that in fact brought our spirits up or not. So I am here, Stella. I'm leading us through this holiday romance, and I am followed by probably my cohort that would be in an antique store making all sorts of, being in the back reading instead of actually doing inventory, etc. It's my good friend, Tom Panarese.
Hi. No, I'm the one who accidentally knocks something over.
Which was in fact Sasha. Yeah, all the buttons went aflying.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So that works. So thank you.
You're quite welcome.
Hello.
Hi, yeah. We made it to a break.
Mm-hmm.
And soon we'll have a couple weeks and then another break.
Yeah.
Are you holding up okay?
Yeah, I'm there. Yeah. It comes and goes in waves of feeling just utterly exhausted and then having some good days and stuff like that. But it's been very, very busy. I'm trying to be as patient as I can. How about you?
Yeah, I would say same here. Definitely. Yeah. Ups and downs, and have been, you know, changing some things in terms of how curriculum is developed, and there's, you know, pushback, even though it's, you know, for the best for them. Mm-hmm. So then you got to deal with bad feelings. So yeah, it's been, I think, emotionally exhausting for me. So I'm looking forward to this particular break, but I did get to see the Buffalo Bills play live.
Yeah.
And it was like 90% an authentic Bills game because it was rather cold. It was 19 mile per hour winds. Some snow drifted through, but it wasn't a full on, you know, blizzard.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have to clean the stands, but they did win, which was exciting. And it was a heck of a game because it was, I think, the second most lead changes in an NFL game. So
wow.
I can imagine my stress, but I would prefer to see that in a win than a win that was like crushing. And then,
yeah,
you know, it wasn't much of a football game to watch. So yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Well, here we are. Yeah. We are going to talk about this lovely book. I in fact got my copy from Target, just so happened to get it. And it was a quote unquote Target exclusive, which in fact had an epilogue, which I can mention what happened in that epilogue. It was like 4 pages of an epilogue, which leads into the next book, I guess, that she's going to have in the series, but also a nice edging around the around the pages, which is also okay. Nice. And mine is red, and I recall you in an image that I had posted for my birthday, you said that yours was blue.
Yeah, I ordered mine from bookshop.org, which is a place where you can order books, but you can choose to have a percentage of your purchase donated to an independent local bookstore. So I chose our independent local bookstore here in Charlottesville, New Dominion Bookshop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's really cute, though, is that it's got this sort of like ribbon and poinsettia going along the edges of the book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so that's
yeah.
The same thing that I have.
Yeah,
so
yeah. It's just the cover. Yeah. The cover's like a sky blue instead of a red.
A
and there is no epilogue in the copy that I have. It ends, I think it just ends with the last chapter with Well, we'll get to that, right? So
yeah, it's interesting how much books, and I think I'm gonna like zoom in, but still in a generalization, romance novels or romanticy has become a bit of a racket in that there are all these different editions that you could potentially get. The edges that you have, I mean, that's a rather recent thing from the library. I got an Allie Hazelwood book called Deep End, and I was like, oh, this is lovely. It looks like water because it's between two swimmers. And then I
Gotcha.
really liked that book, and I ended up getting it, I think, from Barnes and Noble. And I thought maybe I would get that, the edges on the side. And then I just got plain one, and then I happened to find it elsewhere. And so I ended up getting the second one and then taking the other one back. But yeah, all the additions. And then also there are some that so L. Kennedy, which you know of because you read The Mistake, they or she will have like different epilogues depending on where you buy it. And so it's like, well, if you want to know everything, you potentially are like buying more than one book. So it's just kind of nuts. I was not that emotionally invested in getting all of that. It just so happened to have a special epilogue. But yeah, it's just become a racket.
It's like a
What is,
DVD or an album or something, like a
yeah,
CD where it's like bonus tracks and
there you
bonus
go.
features that weren't on the previous version of the release.
Yeah, because you got the DVD, the Blu-ray, the 4K, and yeah, whatever else is coming down. Yeah, multiple editions. So yeah, and then it comes out as re-release with more footage or whatever. Yeah. So, what is your history with this novel?
Well,
It
it just came out.
sure did.
This is my and this is the only book I've ever read with this author. In fact, I think with the exception of Season of Love, which is Helena Greer's
All
novel
right,
that we
right.
talked about a couple of years ago, I haven't really read a lot of romance Christmas books. I've seen bits and pieces of Hallmark movies over the years, and I have seen some really good Christmas movies that do center around, like a romance is part of the plot, but no, this is kind of this is virgin snow for me. I just woke open and it's just nice and snowy. So, and it's not Ethan Frome, so
It is not Ethan Frome,
meaning it's
indeed.
not tragic in the way that Ethan Frome is. I really liked Ethan Frome.
Yes. Would you change your mind? Because originally you didn't like Ethan Frome, right?
Well, yeah, like I said on the episode, they made us read it in the 10th grade. That's not a book
Yeah.
that you should read in the 10th grade.
Well, it's a bit. Yeah, I didn't read that until college. So, yeah, and this is my history as well. So, we had two difficult novels in a row. And, Tom put this challenge of, picking up lifting one. And I think I made the joke about smut. And I kind of wanted to go crazy because I thought, what if I do like an elf and, a person or like Santa Claus or like a gingerbread man? I wanted to go a bit nuts. And then this had popped up because I literally had said like Christmas like spirits or something like weird and crazy. But this has popped up, and I had read her First Time Caller, which is similar to or pays homage to Sleepless in Seattle. And that was recommended to me because it takes place in Baltimore. And she is actually, I don't know if she's a native, but she lives in Baltimore. So this takes place in Annapolis, but she mentions Baltimore as well. So nice little connection there. So I thought, well, I really liked that one that she did and kind of read the blurb. And I thought, this is good, I think. Keep it safe in case I want to do something crazy, like Kiss of the Basilisk later for Tom. So this is in fact, yes, my first time with Good Spirits as well. I don't have sadly too much history of the author. I mean, I'm sure if I watched a video with her, maybe an interview, I could have gotten some like educational background, but the blurb really is all you get. And then I did at least like find out a little bit about how she started writing. So I'll give you this very briefly. She is an author of contemporary cozy romances, and she is known for her debut novel, Love Light Farms. She started writing during the pandemic and self-published Love Light Farms. Her books often feature emotionally vulnerable characters. And of course, she is the author of other works such as First Time Caller, as I mentioned, and this book that we have here. She lives in Baltimore with her family and her dog. She had a background, or I guess has really a background in writing based jobs like copywriting and social media. And when she first began, or when she began writing her first novel, which was Love Life Farms, third time I mentioned it, during the pandemic, that was really the time I think to sit down and start writing and start doing things, because we had all that time. And she self-published her debut novel on Amazon Kindle's direct publishing platform. And let me see what that date was. First published November 10th, 2021. Yes, I do recommend First Time Caller for anyone who might be interested in, yeah, if they like Sleepless in Seattle and those sorts of vibes. There's another one, And Now Back to You is the second in that series. I can't recall what that was supposed to be like. And then this one that we're reading right now, Good Spirits, as Tom said, was very recently published, officially October 21st, 2025. Yeah. So here we are. So that's basically it. Do you have anything to say?
No, I do not have anything to add. Yeah.
So I'm sorry that I don't know her background education-wise or other things, but yeah. There okay. we go. So we'll get into the plot synopsis. Funnily enough, I asked ChatGPT, I was like, hey, could you give me a plot synopsis for Good Spirits? And it started giving me, it sure did give me a plot synopsis, but it was of some other novel and with like two other leads. And I was like, the leads in this novel are named Harriet and Nolan. And then it said like thinking. And then it just like changed. It was nuts. So all that to say, I don't know how many young folk actually use or listen to our show, but ChatGPT does often make mistakes. And so there you go. But I did find a place. It was called So Brief that gave a nice plot synopsis. And if I feel like I need to add anything, then I will add something. But here we go.
Okay.
On the first day of December, Harriet York's morning is a mess. A busted knee, a misdelivered package, and a cat with an attitude. She receives her annual impersonal invitation to the York Family Christmas Gala, a reminder of her strained family ties. Harriet, who owns the Crow's Nest Antique Shop, tries to keep her spirits up with holiday traditions and oversized decorations. But as she settles in for a cozy night, a strange man appears in her living room. Nolan, who claims to be the ghost of Christmas past, sent to help her mend her ways. Harriet's skepticism and humor clash with Nolan's ghostly seriousness, setting the stage for a haunting that's anything but ordinary. Nolan, the ghost of Christmas past, is used to haunting the worst of humanity, but Harriet is different, messy, stubborn, and unexpectedly kind. Their first encounter is a comedy of errors, with Harriet demanding proof of his ghostliness and Nolan growing increasingly exasperated. He explains the rules, she must revisit her past to learn from her mistakes, and he cannot move on until she does. Harriet resists, refusing to take his hand or believe in his magic, but Nolan is bound to her for the holiday season. Their banter is sharp, their chemistry immediate, and both are left unsettled by the strange sense of familiarity between them. After Harriet refuses to cooperate, Nolan visits the Department of Hauntings and Spirits, a surreal office hidden in plain sight. He consults with Isabella, his no-nonsense supervisor, about the oddity of his assignment. Nolan is unsettled by how nice Harriet is compared to his usual cases, and Isabella warns him that mistakes aren't made in their line of work. He's haunting Harriet for a reason, even if he can't see it yet. The bureaucracy of the afterlife is both comic and ominous, and Nolan leaves with a sense of foreboding, realizing that the consequences of failure could be dire for them both. At the Crow's Nest, Harriet deals with difficult customers and the weight of her own self-doubt. She's haunted by memories of her family's coldness and her own perceived failures. When Nolan appears again, their dynamic shifts. He brings her coffee and they begin to share more of themselves. Harriet's kindness and vulnerability start to break through Nolan's gruff exterior. She questions the nature of her sins, and Nolan, despite himself, is drawn to her warmth. Their connection deepens even as they both try to keep their guard up. Nolan finally convinces Harriet to take his hand, and they're swept into her childhood. A lavish law firm lobby, a train garden, and a moment of innocent rebellion. Harriet's mother is cold, her father indifferent, but young Harriet finds joy in small things and solidarity with her sister. The memory is bittersweet, revealing cracks in Harriet's family and the origins of her longing for acceptance. Nolan is surprised by the lack of true wrongdoing, and both are left wondering what, if anything, Harriet needs to atone for. Back in the present, Harriet reflects on her fractured relationship with her sister, Samantha, and the loss of her beloved Aunt Matilda. She reaches out to Samantha, hoping for reconciliation, but is met with silence. Nolan reappears and their banter resumes, but there is a growing tenderness between them. Harriet's optimism is tested, but she clings to her traditions and the small comforts of her home. The haunting is no longer just about penance. It's about connection, memory, and the possibility of healing. Nolan and Harriet travel to a memory of Harriet cutting down her first Christmas tree alone. The scene is both comic and poignant. Harriet struggles with the saw, gets stuck, and ultimately triumphs, pine needles in her hair and joy in her face. She explains her need to prove she can do things on her own, a legacy of her family's emotional distance. Nolan is moved by her resilience and begins to see her not as a case, but as a person he wants to protect. Their physical closeness grows, and the lines between ghost and human, assignment and companion begin to blur. A trip to a memory involving Holiday Jam leads to a messy, intimate moment, but also a painful argument. Harriet suggests that Nolan's haunting might be about his own unresolved issues, not hers. Nolan lashes out, wounded by hope he can't bear, and Harriet is left hurt and alone. Their separation is brief but agonizing, and both are forced to confront the depth of their feelings for each other. When they reunite, apologies are made, and their bond is stronger for having survived the storm. As Harriet and Nolan continue their journeys, they question the true nature of unfinished business. Harriet wonders if she's meant to help Nolan move on rather than the other way around. Their roles begin to invert. Harriet becomes the helper, Nolan the one in need. They share stories, comfort each other, and their mutual attraction intensifies. But the rules of the afterlife loom large, and both are haunted by the knowledge that their time together is limited. Nolan begins to dream for the first time in a century, dreams of Harriet vivid and sensual. Under a ceiling suddenly blooming with mistletoe, Nolan and Harriet share their first real kiss, a moment of magic that transforms them both. Their love is no longer a secret, but a force that changes the very air around them. The boundaries between ghost and human, past and present, are blurred by the power of their connection. Harriet and Nolan search the crow's nest for clues to Nolan's unfinished business. Amidst the clutter and chaos, they find moments of joy and connection. The music box, the compass, the mittens all become symbols of ways their lives have intertwined. The true key is not an object, but the love they have built together. The compass of Nolan's past, a symbol of his unfinished business, is found in Harriet's shop, pointing always to her. Isabella warns Nolan that the consequences of failing to move on will affect them both. The rules are unyielding and time is running out. Nolan and Harriet cling to each other, making the most of every moment, but the specter of separation hangs over them. Their physical relationship deepens, but so does the ache of impending loss. Harriet's family drama comes to a head at the annual gala, where she finally stands up for herself and chooses her own happiness over their approval. Nolan is by her side, supportive and loving, but both know that their time is running out. Harriet chooses a dress that defies her mother's expectations, a small act of rebellion that signals a larger shift. She's no longer willing to shrink herself for the comfort of others. With the compass revealed, Nolan's magic grows unstable, and the rules of the afterlife close in. Harriet and Nolan decide to stop running from the inevitable and focus on the present, making memories, sharing gifts, and loving each other as fiercely as they can. Their love is a rebellion against fate, a choice to find joy even in the face of goodbye. In a harrowing journey to the day of Nolan's death, Harriet nearly drowns, and Nolan must save her. The experience unlocks memories for both. Nolan remembers seeing Harriet in his final moments, a sign that their souls have always been connected. The compass, once a symbol of unfinished business, is revealed to point not north but to Harriet. The true lesson is clear. Their love is not about penance, but about finding home in each other. With the compass in hand, Nolan is given a choice by the afterlife. Move on to peace or return to Harriet. The waiting room is a place of reckoning, where he is confronted by Isabella and Matilda and finally understands that Harriet was always his unfinished business. Their souls are meant to be together, and the choice is his to make. Nolan chooses to return to Harriet, but not before both must endure the pain of separation. Harriet waits, her memories intact, her hope burning like a candle in the window. She learns to let go, to trust that love will find its way home, and to believe that she is worthy of being chosen. Harriet and Samantha begin on a path towards reconciliation as well. As Harriet prepares to let go, a knock at the door signals Nolan's return. He has chosen her, and together they step into a future built on love, hope, and the promise of every tomorrow. Their story is not about penance or regret, but about the magic of being seen, chosen, and loved exactly as they are. Nolan and Harriet are reunited, their love stronger for all they have endured. The afterlife's rules have been rewritten by the power of their connection, and they are free to build a life together. The candle in the window burns bright, a symbol of hope, home, and the enduring magic of love.
And if you have the Target exclusive, or if you don't, just so you, I can let you know what happened. It is 9 months later. No, she's not pregnant. I just thought I would say that. But it is 9 months later. And it's Nolan's POV. And he kind of helps out and works in the shop. And who should appear in the shop but Death? And Nolan knows right away who it is and basically tries to kick Death out. Death is looking for some floor lamps for her new space. And he says no. And she says, Death says, I'm not here for you or her. I was here for me. And then kind of walks on by and Nolan tells Harriet who it was. So Death is going to be the next romantic lead in the sequel. I kind of want, I don't know if BK Borson is going to do this because she might just do het couples, but it would be interesting to have Death with Sasha. But anyway,
yeah, that would be really, really interesting.
Yeah, but that's a podcast for another time. First question, of course, is did you like it, Tom?
Oh yeah, I really did. I went in, you know, just hopeful, or in the very least to just have fun reading it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like a third of the way, halfway through, and I'm like really invested in these two characters. And I wanted to see how this was going to work out. You know, there were certain things that happened toward the end that were kind of predictable. Like I could totally tell that, okay, they're meant for each other. I didn't clock the whole he saw her before he died thing. I thought that was an interesting twist. But by the end, I was like really, really happy for these two. And it's funny because we've read a lot of like – highbrow, highfalutin literature, right?
Sure,
and
sure.
Novels like this, though, I don't know, they draw me in sometimes more than something that's considered quote literary. And mm-hmm. I think it's just because there's bits and pieces of stereotyping or tropes in these characters, but they're fun to read, and I really like this book. I might actually buy the sequel when it comes out.
Ooh. And then we'll have a sequel on required reading. Yeah, mm. I was hesitant. You know, I was hoping, oh, could I find it in the library? And then I wouldn't have to, you know, pay money and have it in case I don't like it. But there was too long a hold. So I did have to purchase it. But I don't regret this particular purchase. It took me longer than it normally would have. I think just life was getting in the way. And I was bummed about it. I was like, man, I wish I had more time to read this. And then I got to a certain point and I thought, listen, if this guy moves on and Harriet, you know, is just on her own and it's like a contented / realistic ending, I'm gonna be really upset. And I told Tom we're gonna cancel this episode. 109 is just gonna be a void in the required reading backstock or whatever. Yeah, so I was concerned about it. And so I think that we talked about romance novels, you know, in the past as a genre. I think they do have, there's a particular stigma about them. I think it's shifted a little bit just because of how popular they currently are, contemporary adult romances. But, you know, in the past, you know, even my mom jokes, she's like, you shouldn't be reading that. Because I think way back when, you know, when she was a teenager, you know, Sweet Valley High and all those, the Fabio colors and everything, you know, that would present you as a particular person.
Flowers in the Attic.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Family drama. But, you know, I think Good Spirits is a prime example of something that, yes, could be considered a romance. I would almost say it's like, it's like fiction with romantic elements, like, because there definitely is some strong drama here. Mm-hmm. But has such depth of characters and characters that have real life issues and things, you know, that we can talk about that. I think it's a prime example of why you should not judge, you know, either someone or the book itself if it has the term, you know, romance associated with it. So yeah, I highly recommend Good Spirits.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, where to begin? So my first question is like to break down these two characters. And then I have several sub questions under that. So if we were to just start and talk about Harriet and mm-hmm. Nolan, why were you so drawn in by them?
Now, at the beginning, they're very much like almost typical characters from sort of a, I don't know, like a romance movie, like where she's a mess, sort in some way, or like very colorful and kind of quirky, and he's like this gruff, and he's Irish, and he's, you know, the name, a name like Nolan, right? You know, but I think the fact that they both have baggage, especially her, drew me in. The whole thing with her mother, and then the flashbacks to the past, like especially the one where like they go back and they're like at a farmer's market or something in Baltimore, and they see her, but she's like in lawyer mode from like way back when, and there's like a whole backstory there, and I'm like, okay, this is really fascinating. She always hasn't always been in the natural, like, you know, Christmas queen sort of role that she plays with all the Christmas threw up in here. She's witty without being overbearing. She's messy without being the type of character who you're like, who you get tired of the mess. You know what I mean? Like sometimes you have a character who's kind of a disaster, and after a while, you're just like, I'm losing my patience with you. I didn't feel like Harriet had it together, and I like the fact that she also had, you know, she had her friends and stuff, but she had like this memory of Matilda, and I just that connection. And also, if I'm and tell me if I clock this wrong, there's a certain amount of like body positivity going on here, because I got this sense that Harriet's like curvy and not severely thin. Like the way Nolan describes her, I don't know. I was picturing somebody who is not like stick thin, rail thin, Hallmark movie perfect. And I think that was what I caught when I pictured her, with like we're talking about somebody who's just who's shapely, and it's, I felt like she was giving us some body positivity there. So I did appreciate that about Harriet
Yeah,
and the
I clocked
writer.
that as well,
Yeah.
just to support you in that.
Yeah. Borison writes them with a lot of good chemistry. I like the patter between them when they're not getting along. It's almost like an old movie in places, you know? And I thought that was very well done, and it kept me on my toes in terms of like wanting to keep reading and wanting to keep reading. And I think the first person narrative shift from chapter to chapter worked too.
Yep. I think I don't want to repeat what you have said, because I think you said a lot of great things about the different characters. I think I'll add with Harriet that she does have some legitimate, I am unsure if I should use the word, I would say it's lowercase t trauma, with family, just some tough things. And but she does not
Baggage.
go, yeah, absolutely. But she doesn't go through life, woe is me, all the time. There are certainly those moments where she considers, especially as she's weighing options, or she has those moments of what she could be real with Nolan and say what she really thinks, or, kind of hide and push it down like she has been. But she doesn't walk through life constantly thinking, like she's trying to make it, day to day. She's trying to live and be happy, but she also is, and this is, I think we've talked about this, of course, in terms of empathy, that there's a dangerous level, like how empathy can become toxic. And so there's always, there's a golden mean, as Aristotle said, right? Because she really does want to please people, like she's a people pleaser, so there's a toxic level to that. I enjoy seeing that, but you also see the results of her always trying to be kind to people and not ruffle feathers. And it starts at the very beginning with that woman trying to give back the what she did. It wasn't really trying, the music box. And I thought, man, antique stores, I'm pretty sure there's a strict no return policy. So that's something that I like about her. There's also something with, and I don't know if Borison does this intentionally, but in, I could say Greek mythology, I'll at least specify, because this is my knowledge base, with low Latin, I'll say poetry, something that I have seen not only in Ovid, some of his poems, but in Virgil as well, this idea of not really unkempt hair, but hair that is unrestrained, gives off this impression of like the freedom of that particular character. And So I love that. And I think you see that because of the other times, I think at the farmer's market, definitely initially going to the gala and probably the flashback at that previous gala where all the stuff went down, that she tries to control all of her hair. 'Cause I'm just imagining like a really curly mane and, you know, put it in a bun and have it controlled. And that's very much not her. And she's more of a wild spirit, which I appreciate that Nolan likes that about her. Nolan takes me a little bit longer to attach myself to, and I think that is intentional because I think of the two, Harriet kind of takes the spotlight, even though it's a dual POV novel. But you, because you meet Harriet first, I think you attach yourself to her. And there were, I think I appreciate Borison not trying to overdo like an Irish accent. It comes in a couple times, and I wondered like, oh, would he say some of these things? But also, do you want someone to be heavy-handed with this? This isn't, you know, Outlander. But yeah, you kind of get this gruff sense about him, whether this is his past as a fisherman. Who knows? You don't get too much of a sense of who he is. I think we go to his past a couple times. So he's still a bit of an enigma, but I think you get enough from him, and especially about as he starts to develop these feelings for Harriet to better understand who he is. So you kind of discover him, you know, on the page and through that relationship, which I think is a reversal to a certain extent, because a lot of times women or female characters, sometimes their character is based off of a male. And I feel like the reverse is true here, where you get a little piece of Nolan, but I think more of his character is developed because of Harriet.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that's one of the things that made the novel work. And within books like this, I tend to be more invested in the female character than I am the male character. I can't explain why that is. I just find, especially lately, find female protagonists more intriguing in many cases.
Do you think you're a misandrist?
No.
That'd be amazing if you
It's just
said yes.
I've read too many male-centered books where
Of
it's like
course.
it's a guy and I don't know, they're just not as likable or as complicated and or as messy. And it's just it's, you know,
Yeah.
so.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. I think we started to touch upon this, but how would you describe the struggles that they each have?
Obviously they're both trying to come to terms and accept something. Nolan's obviously one of loneliness, right? And he's become so cynical over the years of doing the job. It's almost like he's burned out from it. So that's where the gruff personality can come in, and he's really distancing himself because he probably does realize, and he does realize pretty early that she's different and starts to get kind of the attraction to her and stuff, and that this is a totally different assignment. With Harriet, I think her struggles are like out front, because the big thing is that, you know, she took over the shop from her aunt when her aunt passed. And there's a bit in the beginning where she just talks about or narrates how not only did she save the shop from going under, but like it's a profitable enterprise. Like she does, it's doing really, really well. And that's really all on her and some real good business acumen. But it doesn't matter in the eyes of her parents because they're, but we don't know why yet. But like something about this is like they would still be disappointed in her because she didn't do what they wanted. And that's like one of the major struggles. We don't get a ton about her past loves, except for I think the guy she was with back when she was a lawyer.
A jerk.
Were they engaged or they were just a boyfriend or he was just a boyfriend?
You know, it seemed like it was pretty serious. So if they were not engaged, I cannot recall off the top. It was like it was on the cusp, I would say.
Well, because he was getting along really well with
Yeah.
the mother to
Donna
the point
York.
where I think in one of the flashbacks, they're walking ahead of Harriet and he's kind of
Yes.
making comments about how she's been keeping in line or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like she's on a leash with him or something. It's really, and overall, the whole thing is really, like the flashbacks really give us insight to, like, you know, why there's this conflict and how she really has freed herself. But there's she's even struggling with the choice she made because of being that people pleaser. That was very realistic.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, especially, you know, you and I both teach seniors, mm-hmm. and having pressure, you know, from parents or what they believe that they need to do in order to fit into a particular mold. And just like the concern, you know, that I have when those sorts of things happen, I should say. I had a meeting with two parents this year who are like so grade focused on their child. I was like moments away from being like, your philosophy and mine did not align. It was all about college. And they're like, should we get him to drop your class so that, you know, that's what we're thinking about. I'm like, okay, what? So anyways, all that to say that, yeah, this stuff really does happen. And, you know, if you have especially like high powered family members that have already established this legacy and they expect you to fall into it and you don't really fit that, how hard that is and how draining on your mental and emotional health. So that's definitely the Harriet thing, is just that is not who she is, and she was forced to play that particular part. And then when she decided to advocate for herself, then it's seen as this betrayal, and she takes that as a betrayal, you know, and that she hurt all of these people and she's kind of the villain in the story. And so lots of layers with that, and she can really do no right, like everything. I think when she finally goes to the gala and she's got that plum dress on instead of the navy blue, which was the dress code, and the mother immediately doesn't even greet her, she just says like that's plum or something like that. Like immediately a criticism. With Nolan, it is interesting. I feel like it's not as overt. It is, I think, very much loneliness, and you only get it with these short vignettes, with the exception of him with his father, which I think was the most intriguing one, but he wants to get out of there so quickly that you can't really deep dive into what's actually happening there.
Yeah.
But you know, one of them, he's just sitting at a table eating soup, reading a book by himself. And of course, the fisherman life for him, it's a smaller boat, so he's by himself. Yeah. And of course, we can discuss, or, you know, it's something to think about, whether being alone necessarily equates to loneliness. And I don't think that is, like, some people choose to be alone. I need to be alone in order to recharge after a day. Mm-hmm. I think that you're probably the same. And
yeah.
But this, I think that the aloneness has like seeped into, or has become being lonely as well. Yeah. And maybe not having a purpose. So that was his past life. I think with the current life, it is interesting because he's still alone, even though he's surrounded by these other people, but they're all like not good people, it seems like. So I think there's definitely like a disillusionment with humanity. And then also like he's just ready to move on. And so I think it's very hard for him. Yeah, so there are a couple of layers for him, but I think, going back to loneliness.
Yeah, the Harriet thing too, what I liked about it is just kind of going back, like she clearly had that moment of like, I'm striking out on my own. And we get those a lot in movies, right? And it's the really inspiring song on the soundtrack and everything's great. And we're rooting for her. We never really get that messy struggle once the adrenaline has dropped. And you're like, you really are figuring this out on your own, and you are scared and you are worried about what you've done and who you've done it to. And I think Harriet in the beginning of the novel is very much still in that. And I was very glad that we got that, because it made her more interesting as a character.
Yeah, absolutely. Nolan. Well, yes, Nolan is a ghost, but not a scary one. It's kind of like Casper. How would you say, is there any similarity, or is it mostly differences, his past as a fisherman versus his existence as a ghost?
The independent stubbornness is definitely there both times. And like, why does he go out on the boat the night he dies, right? Like, by himself, it's just one of those things where it's like a dumb decision, but he's very hard-headed. And then he butts heads with his boss, Isabella, and such. You pointed out the loneliness of him eating, drinking soup and stuff, but then like there's the fact that he like knits. Like, and he doesn't want Harriet to know because he like made her something, but he said it was from like he bought it in like 1976 from a store or whatever it was.
Oh, yes. Well, it keeps changing because he can't keep his story straight, which is funny.
Yeah. And then there's the fact that he and Harriet, at the end of the novel, we see that they both have the same cat, Oliver, who is
not even their cat.
Walking, not even their cat, it was Matilda's cat. Yeah. And you know, this cat named Oliver, which I don't know if Borison's making a reference to the Disney movie from the mid-80s.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of cute. But yeah,
so no, Boulin? I don't know.
Yeah.
If I sensed it was French, you'd be able to tell me.
Yeah, I did not catch it. I was wondering if it was Gaelic.
Oh,
since he was Irish.
That's true, could be.
Yeah. So he's bitter and hardened, and he would be that, like, the life of a fisherman is not forgiving, right? And so they're known for their gruffness and the strength and things like that. And I, you know, especially the sort of rugged Irish fishermen, or, you know, or at least my ancestors, the Newfoundlanders. But he is really hiding something, and yeah, I think that is good. And I think his fed upness with his job makes him a fun ghost of a character because he just wants to get this over with through the first half of their adventure together. Cause he's like, usually this only lasts a couple of weeks, and then Ghost of the Present steps in and does his job, and she won't let it go. And he's just like, oh my God. So he's so impatient with her at first. He's just like, let's get it on. And he's like tapping his watch, his clock's ticking. I found that funny, and I found that almost endearing about him, because it was like, at least first, is like, there's nowhere else I could be anywhere else right now. So,
the bureau. I'm happy to see that the afterlife also has bureaucracy.
I've watched enough of The Good Place to know that.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I've not seen it, though people recommend it to me. But yeah, I mean, we're living in so much red tape, so it's good to know that it's elsewhere. Or maybe it's bad to know, like, why can't we just be done with it? But yeah, I don't know that I have much to add, with the exception of, as I mentioned before, just that he's surrounded by people. So I think that's why he doesn't deal well with them, is because, you know, he was on the boat by himself, and now all of a sudden he's got to deal with these people all the time, once a year. But yeah, he potentially likes those moments, maybe when he's at home with his cat. Is the development of their relationship, apart from the romantic aspect, given enough time?
I'm going to say yes, through when they consummate it, because we could talk about the spice at some point later on, but the part after he has to leave and before he comes back, I felt could have been longer, you know,
at the end.
I felt there could have been a little bit more time. There's also something I wish could have been a little deeper, but we'll get to that. But but overall, I felt it was a pretty good build-up. The fact that they were thinking about each other, dreaming about each other, and then like their first encounter with each other was pretty steamy, but didn't go all the way. And and they were both cautious at first and stuff. So it's I thought it was a pretty good build. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. So, I mean, going to people's past, that's a pretty intimate thing anyways. Like, you're being very vulnerable, and you're showing these things that could be, you know, lowercase t, traumatic, for you to relive. And then, of course, someone's along the ride with you, pointing it out to you and seeing what you have potentially done wrong. So, yeah, I was looking for, like, what is this like? Is it just going to be these two people that are, like, in parallel going together, and then all of a sudden there's some sort of inciting incident and then they're making out? But I feel like you can, which is fine, but also there needs to be believability for me. But I feel like there is a great development between them, with their ups and downs, trying to get a feel for each other and their personalities and who they, you know, who each are, that seem realistic, of two people who are strangers, you know, then developing. So I think there's, you know, an uneasy friendship, then a friendship, and then a obviously the romance as well. So I think enough pages. And I would say that Borison waits a while. I mean, it's halfway, I think, 50% until the first kiss, which is a little bit late in terms of general percentage when things like that happen. But I am fine with that. I think that there is a realistic build. So in what ways do you feel like Harriet and Nolan support one another and help each other grow?
I mean, with Harriet helping Nolan grow, it's pretty obvious, right? Like, at one point, she does hypothesize that maybe she's there for him. And then we find, of course, there for each other because there are two souls who were supposed to be together but were existing at different times, etc. But she's weirded out by going to his past, but at the same time, not as much as he is. And she starts to think about, okay, like, he think about the why they did that. And again, she's a smart character. She's not a ditz. And I think that helps. But with him helping her, he's a really great emotionally supportive partner. Whether it's comforting her and being like, I'll be here for you, or confronting her mother and kind of being the fly in the ointment at that gala with her, and giving her the dress and everything. So he is very supportive. So I think your point about them becoming very, very good friends before lovers was really good, because I think you're right, Borison built this really well, so we can see the bond they have and the way they are there for each other.
Yeah, I would add, at my school, we talk about just, and I'm a DEI coordinator, so we talk about the importance of just showing up for students, or for really anyone. Just being there, I think, is, it's not 100%, right? You still got to do a little bit more, but it's a high percentage, right? To just be there and be present for people and to, you know, show them that you're there for them. And so I think that the fact that Nolan does show up, especially at the gala, I think that is a big thing, is amazing. And then he goes the extra mile because he defends her, because the most painful scenes, but probably the gala or the dinner was probably the most painful scene, is that people are like going after her and like making jokes and stuff because she threw up in court, and her own father, and no one is defending her, you know. And she looks to her sister constantly. Like, there are two times that she looks at her sister, and her sister's doing nothing. It happens at the gala too. But to have someone there in her corner and actually defend her, I think speaks volumes. Sometimes he hurts when he helps, because, you know, I didn't understand how it was phrased, because he said, like, don't be a steamroller. And I think you mean don't be steamrolled. But yeah,
like, don't it was be a like doormat.
It was a weird phrasing that might have been a mistake, but it was intent versus impact. And that was like a really harmful time for, or afterwards, that was really hard for Harriet. I think Isabella had visited then, and she was going to give her that music box for free. But yeah, so certain things like that, where he kind of steps in it because he's trying to be encouraging, but he says it in the wrong way. So I add on to that. And then I think, obviously, you know, helping him move on and being that person that he's kind of been searching for, I think, is really beautiful, but also someone that can bring him out of his curmudgeoniness. And because he, I think, just inadvertently falls in love with, you know, her mess and her craziness and the holidays and all of that stuff, whereas he very much is like the Scrooge of this tale to a certain extent, and bringing him out of his loneliness too. So I think those would be, they are very compatible in that way, that they're offering things that the other person doesn't have. So I think, but we'll obviously continue to talk about Harriet and Nolan, but you did mention, of course, the spicy scenes. And we here on Required Reading with Tom and Stella, we like to talk about spicy scenes.
Yes, we
So
do.
I don't have a question necessarily laid out here, so let me just come up with one really quickly. Do you feel like it is open door? I think you could probably consider it explicit. Is it too
Yeah.
much, or do you think just enough? Do you think that they are choreographed and plotted in a good way and kind of divvied up within the page count in a great way? And does it merge the physical aspects with the emotional aspects well?
I think it merges the physical and emotional very well. I'm going to defer to you on the pacing because you've read a lot more of this than I
Sure.
have. It's certainly when it started, I thought it was paced well, but I don't like we go from there, like how hot and heavy it gets. And I liked the first encounter where they're really kind of just getting each other off without having sex, without, you know, and I thought the, the first time I saw him use a word, the word that he uses for the penis, I was like, okay, it's that type of book, you know? And I was like, okay, but I can do that. I'm like, all right, so we're
Yeah, you
going in
never
there,
know
and
until
there,
you
you
hit
know,
something.
and she's very, but she's very, very strategic with the language she uses for the female, right? You know, so, but you know, and stuff. But I thought it was, I thought that first scene was actually, it was the first time where they have the encounter and he's, you know, fingering her, et cetera, et cetera. I think that was one of the hottest scenes for me. It was really, really sensually written. And it was like, damn, it was erotic in a big way. The other ones were too. The only thing I didn't like was how like she kept using some sort of version of like licking her inside her mouth when like they're kissing with tongue. It was that drove me crazy because I was like, what is this description? Like our tongues could melt together or something. It could be a lot more hot. And it's like licking inside her mouth. And I'm like, it's the picture I'm getting is very, very strange. And I'm like, please stop using that phrase.
Be sure to pass it on to BK
You
Borson if I ever meet her. Could
should.
you please? I will say that she's not an anomaly. Like I've read that countless times about like I licked into her mouth. I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Oh, God.
So I mean that's yeah, they just how I guess instead of saying French kiss, they gotta do it in a different way. So I will say you're not. Yeah. Sorry about that. Yes, I would say pacing wise and amount wise is potentially lower, a lower ratio of like scenes and page count or chapter count than maybe my typical. But still, the ones that we get, I think, are intense and well done. And I think she makes use of them well. And you're absolutely right that I think the first scene, even though there's not like the PIV, that
Yeah.
you really get that sense of intimacy that they're finally, I think, letting down their walls, both
Yeah.
metaphorically and
That's good.
literally, and you know, and being together. And then when they do finally have sex, it's after the gala, which I think is really like that. You know, if you
Yeah.
consider it depends on people's philosophical ideas of sex, but if you consider that like the pinnacle of someone's intimate relationship with somebody, that it happened alongside the like I think most emotional moment that they have had after that. So I would say, yeah, that they are well done. Yeah, you can never tell until you get to the first one, like what type of romance novel are we
Yeah.
about to read? Because the terminology, you can't tell. You could have like a really sweet girl, and then all of a sudden she's talking some crazy stuff. You're like, wow, this is taking a turn.
She's using the C word.
I know, seriously.
Yeah, but I mean, I thought it didn't go too far. Like it didn't
No.
get like pornographic in the sense that all of a sudden we're in a really smutty novel
Oh,
because it wouldn't
sure.
have fit the mood and the tone of the rest of the story.
No. This is not Kiss of the Basilisk, which I do recommend, but we won't talk about that yet.
Not a penthouse letter either.
It's not a penthouse letter, no. Let's see here. Okay, so this novel loosely, okay, follows the idea of A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens, a novel, by the way, which Nolan hates. In what ways does, if at all, really, Good Spirits build upon what that novel does, and in what ways does it maybe fall short?
I thought it was clever in the way it was essentially spoofing the Three Spirits and all that with the very bureaucratic thing in Isabella as this kind of hardlining boss who's like in cahoots with the ghost of Matilda to because there's like a purpose behind it and everything. But I also like the fact that, like, you know, there was an issue with, I think, like one of at one point at the beginning, like with one of the death spirits or something, and she had to go take care of the mess, which is why she wasn't in her office. And the idea of that they have magic they can control, but it gets out of control when they're out of control. Yeah, I thought those bits were funny and fun to read and clever. Falling short, I maybe a little bit more, but we could have seen a little bit more about, like, if he knew what the consequences were for him not doing his job. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I felt like there was some stuff that might have been left out, or does he know what happens with the present and the future ghosts after he leaves? I can't remember if he says he knows what happens or if he just doesn't care or doesn't know, you know? So I guess there could have been a little bit more in it, but overall I thought it was clever.
Yeah. I would say that he probably doesn't care. Frankly, he's just ready to do his thing in the past.
And my work here is done.
That's basically it. Yeah. He's very much a, cog in the machine, I think, in his mind. I did find it funny that Harriet brought up that particular book and no one's like, oh, it's completely unrealistic, all of that stuff. I think the fanciful nature of it, I think, gets to it. Obviously it immediately stops because Harriet is not a bad person, but yeah, the whole aspect of, you know, wouldn't you want the opportunity to sort of fix your wrongs and course correct? And wouldn't you want that chance to do that? Which, you know, you should be trying to do that on your own. You shouldn't really need prodding from anybody. But I do like that. It might have been too much, but it would have been interesting to see if he would have had any anecdotes from previous people or experiences to maybe talk to Harry about. But, you know, maybe that would have just been off track if he was talking about some friend named or some person named Fred, you know, went to his past and all of that stuff.
It wouldn't have tracked with his character if he had like a full memory that seemed like pride in his work. If he was complaining about something, that would have been in character.
Yeah.
You know?
It's true. Yep. Yeah, I think the office space sort of feel of it is a fun little twist, because you kind of wonder, oh, were other people in the Scroogeverse, were they kind of waiting for that? I wonder if it's the gravitas is maybe less in this novel than it is with Christmas Carol.
Yeah, Christmas Carol is more of a morality play.
Yeah, and there are definitely, I mean, people are dying. From hunger and poverty,
it's Dickensian Christmas.
Yeah. Which is interesting because Harriet clearly comes from a privileged background, so there is that through line there. But yeah, I would say it's more, you know, in the line of my own podcast, Dear Reader, out now. It's more of, you know, in the spirit of the Christmas Carol rather than the law of it.
Yeah.
Skipping to the end, Samantha, the sister. Do you feel like the fact that Samantha comes either the penultimate chapter or the last chapter and makes an effort to reconcile, but the reconciliation is not fully shown? It's more like the future, like, we're going to give it a shot. But Donna York, who's the mother, does not make an effort. Does that feel right and satisfying? What are your thoughts about that particular part of the novel, or the whole sub story of Samantha, if you want to go into that?
Yeah, so I didn't care enough about Donna in that. Well, I didn't want Donna. I didn't want Donna to make a reconciliation effort. I wanted her to remain the villain. Her, because the dad is also kind of the villain in a sense. Like, I wanted that uptightness. and that she's not going to make it. She would have to be visited by three spirits to make that change. And I don't think that's going to change. I liked the character of Samantha, and I like the fact that they're going to reconcile at the end, but I didn't get enough of it. That's the one quibble I have with this book. It's like that needed more space, because you have all these moments, bits and pieces of their relationship when they were kind of partners in crime as kids, and then like the number of times where Harriet is looking for her sister to defend her, and Samantha just kind of like stares at the floor. And those sorts of things. So she comes into the shop. I'm like, oh, cool. And she says, I've always been a little jealous of you, which is a bit cliche, I will say, right? We've seen those lines a million
times. That is true. Miscommunication or misunderstanding of the other person.
I wanted more out of that scene, out of that reconciliation. Mm-hmm. I felt like that was one of the purposes that Nolan had, was to reunite her with somebody from her family. Yeah. The other thing about the family, too, is that, and maybe you can clarify it, or maybe I've missed this. Why did Donna hate Matilda?
Oh, we just like in Greek tragedy and myths as well, this whole thing is cyclical. So in a very similar vein, Donna was kind of forced to follow the rules of the family, and Matilda kind of broke away because they used to be close.
Okay, so basically Samantha's the Donna and Matilda and Harriet's the Matilda.
Correct.
So they're breaking that cycle. Yeah, I wanted more of it. I felt like I was glad that the reconciliation's coming, but it could have used like more conversations or something there, or something on Samantha's part that was a little more demonstrative than her walking into the store and apologizing. But it just seemed too short for me.
Yeah.
Even though I wanted it to happen.
Yeah. I am at least glad that there are bits leading up to that, because if that had just happened and there weren't those moments where we're seeing a glimpse into the relationship, I think that would have been worse. But you see them from that first memory where they were in the lobby of the law firm and they were having that discussion about like, you're my best friend, or I really love you and all that stuff. And her trying to text her sister doesn't respond. I think later something happened with Nolan and she tried to call her sister, and her sister said she was in a meeting. And then the other flashback, and then of course the climax at the gala, I would say. So having all of that, I think is a good lead up. Though the gala situation, even that one was potentially scripted in a way that I didn't necessarily agree with. But also when people are heated and in those sorts of moments, I think they do say things that might not make sense in the moment. I should flip to that particular page. But because there was like blame being put on Harriet that like doesn't make sense where Samantha is coming from. But I guess if you take it as, oh yes, you know, she is a bit resentful that, you know, she can quote unquote be free and she can't, then maybe we can let those things slide. I agree with you about, you know, we've seen it before that someone says another, you know, like, you had the greener grass, and they're like, what? I thought you had the greener grass. So we have seen that before. Would it have, if you had seen, maybe not a lengthy scene or lengthening that scene, but if you had, as you had proposed before, more time between when Nolan disappears and when he reappears, and maybe there's another chapter and you got to see them start to reconcile, would you have approved of that?
Yeah. I just felt that it happened maybe a little too fast, one after the other. And that with Nolan out of there for a little bit, this part takes its place for just a little while longer. I felt we needed to spend a little more time there and then have him come in, because she's waiting for him, but she's also got to work. She knows she has to work on herself, you know, because that was part of it. She knew that she was assuming she was never going to see him again. So she knows that she has to get back to herself. So this is like the first step in moving on. Yeah. At the gala they're having, she's like, at one point, 295 is where her conversation with Harriet and Samantha starts. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh yeah, about being busy. And then her, she needs to be pulled out of that, because she also says that my job is asking about me.
Yes.
I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yes.
You are your job. You need to pull yourself out of that, lady. Yeah.
Yeah. And at one point, like,
oh yeah. Yeah, it was the whole, you really think you tried, Harriet. You hit one roadblock and you threw everything away.
Mm-hmm.
You have no idea what I've gone through trying to smooth over the damage you've done. What could Samantha have possibly have done? You lost one partner, I don't even know, like a junior person. Like, what, it just seems like really dramatic what Samantha is saying in that moment.
But there is that moment on 297 where she's like, I'm really happy for you, Sam, and I wish you the best. Like, in other words, this is it. I'm leaving. I'm never going to talk to you again. And this is the kiss off. Harriet, wait. My heart gives a hopeful flutter in my chest. The family picture is in a few minutes. Mom won't want you to stay. And I blink at her, my hope turning to ash. Right, I say. How could I forget my mother's favorite performance of the night? I'll meet you over there. And then Samantha's mask slips. Harriet, she says again. So like... You, it's like almost there, right? Yeah. And then mom barges in and ruins the moment. So that's why I just felt like there was an imbalance between the conflict between them and the resolution between them. There was an imbalance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will say, you know, if we're correct that it's Death and Sasha next time, which would be amazing, then I wonder if, because we've established this group, that we would have Harriet and Nolan as minor characters in that the sequel, and then maybe see that. But that doesn't necessarily excuse a novel from not completing things in its first go, knowing that you have a sequel. So but you know, hope springs eternal, potentially.
At least it's partially resolved.
Yes.
If it was completely unresolved, that would have been, I would not have been happy with that.
Yeah, we were getting to the end. I thought, oh, wow, there's not going to be anybody.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, maybe that's just how it goes. I mean, her mother said, you know, if you walk out, this is it. And Harry was like, I think I'm okay with that. So I thought, well, I don't feel good about it, but I guess it's realistic. But yeah, the Donna York business, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that would ever get reconciled? In the future,
she'd have to lose a significant amount of herself, her pride, her things. Like, she would have to have a complete washout, rock bottom thing, and realize how much she lost. Or Scrooge with the Ghost of Christmas, a Spirit of Christmas Future, you know, like dead and nobody comes to your funeral type of thing. Because she's so committed to this idea of who she's supposed to be. And I think she's too far gone, honestly. Because she's also, funny enough, like an immature adult. You know, like, she would never for a minute consider that she's at fault for any of this. So, yeah, I think it's a potential thing, but it's going to take a lot more work.
Well, another scene I want to talk about, this is on page 241, I believe. But so Isabella comes to the store. She knows something's up. She's been maybe told that something was up because, you know, Nolan was a bit nervous about some of his magic getting out of control. She says some foreboding things to Nolan about consequences. But do you feel like this lines up with the ending? Of course, I should have found the ending. But on page 241, some of the things she says, let's see here. Nolan says, I'm handling it, because he's got a bruise. She says, you're not. You're toying with forces you do not comprehend. Do I need to remind you about your deadline? You must pass Harriet on to her next ghost before Christmas Eve. Let me remind you what happens if you miss it, since I can see you're not concerned. The bruise is just the start. Things will continue to change. You won't be the only one who will bear the consequences. He wonders, you know what that means. I've told you, Harriet was assigned to you for a reason. The decisions you make will impact the both of you. And what does that mean? It means, as I have said, you haven't said anything. Are you threatening Harriet? I'm explaining what happens if you fail. It's very simple. This is your job. If you don't complete your job, you don't move on. Though I find it very interesting that the perception of a threat against Harriet is what finally garnered such a reaction out of you. Yeah, at the very end, you have your orders, you've received your warning. I expect you to adjust course accordingly, channel your inner captain or whatever it is you used to be. Then on page 363, well, I mean, at 362, it's talking about basically he had to wait lifetimes in order to meet Harriet. And then he says, but you couldn't have mentioned it. All this talk about consequences, and you couldn't have just told me that she was meant to be mine. And Isabella says that she couldn't have. And basically, would you have believed me? Nolan, this isn't a training exercise. This is your Harriet, yours. She is made for you as you are made for her. You would have laughed in my face. And he said, perhaps. I told you as much as I could. Anything more and I would have faced consequences on my own. Your trips to the past were meant to speed the process along. Don't you see? The boat when she was a child, how you kept singing the Christmas song she loves best. Before you knew her, she even made the same jam that your mother used to serve you as a boy. She's been waiting for you her entire life, and you've been searching for her just as long. But yeah, do you think the consequences align? Like, is that a good enough explanation of why Isabella was warning him in the shop? Do you feel like, yes, that aligns, that makes sense? Because I felt, when I first read it, I thought, I don't know. I wasn't sure if that made sense, like if they both came together, but I wondered if that was just me.
Well, I know that the way she's telling him because it's like in the context of what he thinks is his job and what he thinks he wants, because he wants to go. He wants mm-hmm. to move on. And so he might be picking up the idea that if I don't do this, I don't move on. Like, I'm really close to the end. I'm on my last day before retirement, you know, that sort of thing. So in the consciousness of her having to put up a front, it does work. It's a little incongruous because she seemed a little too pleasant at the end there. I mean, she's still very steely, and Matilda is definitely more expressive. I do love the fact that they point out how much of an idiot he is.
Yeah.
He didn't make the connection. Oh, like, dude, it was all in front of you. Sorry?
Was it? I don't know. Would you have made that connection?
No.
Oh, okay.
But I like the fact that they're like, for an intelligent man, he's pretty stupid.
I know, but even when they were talking about it, I was like, well, I still don't get what's happening. So,
but it's like, on some level, though, it's like Shakespearean comedy where like the two people who are meant for each other are in each other's orbits for the entire play. And it's not until Act Five where they're like, well, wait, I love you, you know? So it's kind of that where like everybody knows what's going on, but they can't tell them directly. And, you know, because that would mess it up. And I do think her saying, would you have really believed me if I told you? And I think that is a good line, because really he probably wouldn't have.
Yeah.
Especially at the beginning, he would have been like this.
Yeah. Her? Yeah, this person.
Are you kidding me with this? Yeah.
The mess, so, et cetera.
Yeah.
Okay. What did you think of the paranormal premise of the novel? Do you feel like Borison did a good job explaining the magic? In a book like this, does the author really need to?
I like the paranormal presence because she built off of something that we already had cultural knowledge of, right? So we don't have when he says, I'm a ghost of Christmas past, we don't need much more explanation than that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I liked the teleportation, hold my hand, teleportation into the past type of thing, and how they eventually do get used to it. She gets a little more used to it because it's kind of like physically sickening to do it. I like that display of power. I think that because he never really talks, for the longest time, he doesn't talk about how his own magic power works, right? Like, he's like, I can't do that. I can do this, I can do that. I think she tried to toe the line between here's some fun things that his magic can do and, oh, he has magic, let's use it when it's convenient for the plot. You know, like all of a sudden, oh, magic did it, you know, that sort of thing. I don't know if she's totally successful at times, but I do think it adds to the charm of the novel.
Yeah, I chose this because I wanted it to be unhinged, but not too unhinged for mm-hmm. me. And technically, I think you could consider this a monster romance because it's paranormal, I think technically. But yeah, I enjoyed it. Like, you know, we talked about the, you know, if you're going to be going along with the premise of A Christmas Carol, I think you should be fine with this. And yeah, I think the magic is explained as much as it needs to be, like base level. Even Nolan doesn't really know what's going on with his magic. So if your lead character can't explain what's going on, you don't really need to do that much. And that's what magic is, right? You can't really explain it. Now, one thing that inquiring minds want to know, and I think Tom really wants to know, is, listen, when they had the sex for the first time, no condom was in sight. So the question that Tom wants to know is, can a ghostly spirit impregnate a human? Tom?
I have no idea.
Did you notice that no condom was mentioned?
No condom was mentioned. But yeah, wasn't
that's
he...
That's what I was thinking. I was like,
okay, wasn't he feeling more human?
Yeah.
Like, doesn't he have a line way before that to either Isabella or Harriet that like she's making him alive again?
Oh yeah,
in almost the literal sense.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I think it's very possible in that context. Now, can a ghost impregnate a woman? I don't know, Stella. Yeah, I don't know. It depends on the rules of the book.
Yeah.
I'm glad that at least from what you told me that epilogue, she's not pregnant or they have a child. I just don't want to deal with that. In the book, I don't know.
Yes, no, even though it did say, yeah, 9 months later. Yeah, because he has the bruise. He can feel things. He can taste things. Yeah. So he clearly is. I mean, maybe he's just shooting blanks.
When he died, they gave him a vasectomy.
Maybe. A little snip snap. Okay, let's see here. Oh, world building. So I've already mentioned that the next novel is going to follow death. But how well do you feel like we get a sense of place and time in this novel? Not only in terms of Annapolis, Maryland, but also with the paranormal business center and the Crow's Nest, which I think is its own little setting as well. What are your thoughts?
The Crow's Nest, I don't know, you've probably been in them and I've been in them. I've been in antique shops where just kind of like junk shops, basically. There's like, I mean, they're not like
Harriet
junk.
Would take that offensively?
No, you know what I mean? It's not set up like a gallery. It's like there's a bunch of stuff, right? And those sorts of things, they're consignment shops and stuff. So that tracked for me. I've been into a number of those places and I can totally picture the place. I am not familiar. I've never been to Annapolis, so I cannot tell you if that's accurate. The society aspect of it, as stereotypical as it was, the idea that mom is so focused on performance, et cetera, that worked for me. The sense of time in terms of modern day versus the past. Yeah, I think that worked. I mean, there's a timelessness to the situation of the present day in that it didn't need to happen in a specific year. Like, you could open this book up a couple of years from now, read it and be like, okay, it's taking place this year. And it would feel like nothing really changed, you know? And the callback to the past and stuff like that. Yeah, I thought that was done fairly well, because Forreston just kind of gives us snapshots of it, so we don't have to go too far and look for accuracy. But yeah, so I thought it was, you know, I thought it worked pretty well. What do you think?
Yeah,
especially with Annapolis, because I don't know Annapolis. I'm going to punt that to you.
Yeah, so I've been a couple times since my brother was stationed there for several years. I mean, you could have put this anywhere. I didn't necessarily, yeah, beyond like the waterfront, I couldn't necessarily, which I guess is apropos since Nolan was a fisherman, but I couldn't really, you know, see anything that was very specifically Annapolis. Whereas in First Time Caller, even though I'm still like ignorant of many Baltimore places, it was clear what places she was talking about, because she mentions them very specifically of places in Baltimore. So that would be the only thing. So I feel like the Crow's Nest is kind of the main setup. Yeah, I guess I wish I would have known, because Annapolis, you kind of had this townhouse. Let me put it this way, because I think you know this area. It reminds me of Alexandria, because of lots of townhouses and that kind of stuff. So if you've been to Alexandria, you can kind of add water, and then, which there probably is water, I think, anyways.
Yeah, but at the end of, toward the end of Old Town.
Yeah.
You go down all the way King Street. You're by where the harbor essentially is. I know exactly what you're talking about.
So I would say, I mean, just add the Naval Academy and you've got it. So I feel like maybe there's more in terms of, and even there's not really a lot on page when you think about it, but this company of paranormal spirits, I think is kind of the big setup, which is good because of, you know, having a secondary novel with death. And then, oh, does that have something to do with, you know, the things that were going on, some of those spirits and things like that? So I think we're setting something up. She's moving there. I mean, that's a thought at the end because she's buying floor lamps. So hopefully we build upon that because it'd be very shocking if all of a sudden we are in a new place. So I wouldn't say it's like the biggest world building that we've done, but I think that, or that we've seen in novels, in series, you know, like Hunger Games.
Yeah.
But I think it's enough for what we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Oh, Tom, what was the most romantic part of the book for you? What sections, Tom, made you swoon?
Well, I did say how much I liked the first night they spent together.
Oh, yeah.
The gala, I loved him getting with the dress and that whole thing. I really, like, she's so stressing over blue dress and he's like, no, the purple, the plum, et cetera, et cetera. Like, and I thought that, because his mission, part of his mission is essentially letting her be herself, letting her feel like she can be herself. And I thought that he was, again, he had her back and they came in together and it was just like, it was like a perfect type of moment. And then of course she's able to stand up for herself at the gala. And then of course they go home and do it. Yeah. I would say that was probably the most romantic moment. And then one of the other ones was him realizing that he saw her. I think that really had an effect because I was like, I was kind of expecting it the way, especially because the scene where she almost drowns is very well written too, because she's looking at him and it's very comforting. And it's like, so clearly the whatever these two souls are like being together in that moment, because that's when he's alive, is the connection that has to happen, but it's the timing is terrible. So then him helping her and telling her that, I thought was a really, really nice moment as well.
Yeah, that you bring up, of course, another point about explanations, because Harriet's underwater thinking the entire time, well, we're in the past. This is, and I was thinking also, well, we're in the past. This is okay. And then all of a sudden it's not okay. She nearly drowned.
Mm-hmm.
So if people can't see you or interact with you, how are you able to interact with the space around you? Also, I guess that goes into, because they were dressing warmly because it was winter time.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess I feel like there'd be some sort of bubble and you wouldn't necessarily be affected by that. But
if the magic has been acting wonky and he's been hitting his head.
Oh, true.
Maybe it's not fully protecting her.
That is true.
There's the no prize.
Yeah, that is a good no prize. Most romantic part, definitely. Yeah, him sticking up for her, I think, is the most romantic part for me at the gala. I think a very close second, or maybe first, is, you know, after that one flashback between her and her aunt, and that she's kind of pranked meanly by some people. She thought she's going to get kissed by a guy. And he's like, no one would ever kiss you. And then Nolan makes all these mistletoe sprout in the store, and then he gives her a kiss. That was lovely. And absolutely everyone loves a great dressing room scene where, you know, the guy is like swallowing his tongue because, you know, of how beautiful the girl is. So that was lovely. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, final question, I think, before, of course, the big question. Did you like the ending that Nolan comes back and they have an HEA, as they say, a happily ever after? While it would not have made us happy, I'll speak for us, I believe this is true, what would you have thought if it ended with Nolan moving on and Harriet, you know, being on her own temporarily, maybe meeting somebody else?
I think it would have worked. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think she could have made it work. or have a weird, like, ambiguous ending, like the end of The Sun Is Also a Star, where they're on the plane together and they see each other, and that's the very last scene. Like, maybe she sees him and another guy or something. But as this novel is whimsical, it's fairy tale, like, it wouldn't. Morrison would have written it well. It wouldn't have worked. It needed to end the way it did. Mm-hmm. And I wanted them to get back together. Oh, and I liked the way that Matilda stepped in and they pulled strings and red tape and called in all these favors because they were like, no, these two need to be together. And I liked the explanation of that before we went back to Harriet and Nolan together. It was a little bit cheesy at the end, but it earned it.
Yeah, and that he was waiting maybe 2 weeks time because it was hard to, you know, get Matilda from wherever she is. And also that explanation of recently departed or not able to see their loved ones or else they would never move on. Because I'm sure, you know, which would be nice, you know, in the sequel if it's not going to be. Harry is not going to be the lead, but yeah, to see her maybe see Matilda or something would be lovely. Though I am surprised that Nolan hasn't said anything to her. You know, at the
sworn
end.
To well, secrecy, maybe, I don't know.
Oh, maybe, yeah. But yeah, so I do very much like the ending. I wanted them to be together. I was surprised by everything, you know, this soulmate sort of just needing to, in a Benjamin Button sort of way, intersect at the right time. And yeah, if that had happened, I guess it would have been like a contented ending of like, oh, he finally got to move on and she would have been happy for him, but also sad. And then maybe you could have seen something, but I would have been discontented.
Yes. Proposition way off in the future that these two, after they both finally pass him again, and then they become like this ghost of Christmas couple. That it's like, I don't know, like Ralph and Sue Dibny or something going around helping people. I could totally see that. And I think that would be a charming novel.
Lovely. Let's get Borison on the phone. I'm going to start tracking her down because she's somewhere in my vicinity.
You're really good at that. So tracking she people. Should be scared. Stalking that sounds, people.
Yeah, sure. Okay, Tom, would you consider this required reading?
If we're going with, okay, give me a good novel to read around Christmas that's not A Christmas Carol, I would recommend this. I'd, you know, have to give the sort of parental guidance warning, to speak, of the, this does have some, you know, really spicy scenes in it. I really liked it. And if you're, it's just one of those things where like, yeah, I just want to change the pace or something that is not, it's not too sappy or syrupy either. It's fun without being too like Hallmarky in that sense.
Yeah. And I think you have the opportunity. And I think we've done this before where you have maybe something that's on the quote unquote canon of English literature that you would teach. And then you have this tale that pairs well with it, you know, like like a wine and a cheese. And so I think this, if you decided to do A Christmas Carol, which I think is worthwhile some work to do in an English literature class, to pair this with it in some way, or perhaps offer, you know, I don't know, extra credit if they you know, did a book report of some sort on it.
Moms for Liberty would have my teaching license.
Please read Good Spirits.
Yes.
So I think and just outside of the scholastic or educational arena, I think if you're looking for something that is fun and uplifting and got some holiday there, and I think has some real emotional depth to it, I do highly recommend Good Spirits.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So we do have one piece of feedback about The Long Halloween. Yep. From Robert Ward. Speak dropped the day of this recording, so hopefully we'll have some of that in our next episode. But Robert says, fitting day for release. I believe I mentioned before, if you were reading it, but on Tuesday, we saw this was prior to the release of our episode, which was right around Halloween. We saw the release of the new Batman novel, Batman Revolution, which was a sequel to last year's Batman Resurrection, which takes place in the Tim Burton Batverse.
Oh.
So, yeah. Have not read either of those. I might check them out, though.
Yeah, I remember it was recommended previously. And I will say, as a little fun fact, I have a quote unquote superhero club, which basically involves like me and a bunch of young men for some reason. And so we still haven't broken in there, though. Two young women came last time, and we've decided that this is the year of the Batman. And so we watched the 1966 movie, and last time we just started, we do it every day five, we're on a 6-day cycle. We just started the 1989 Tim Burton fan, and more people came to watch that. But also I'm thinking in the back of my head, what am I going to do about Batman Returns? Am I going to fast forward through some spots? I haven't yet decided about that. But yeah, as a nice little aside that I'm rewatching that for the first time in a while.
Nice. So next episode is a multiple of 10. It will be 110. So we're going to have a special. Stella, can you give us what the idea behind that special will be, at least in a vague sort of way?
Sure. That's nice how you just toss it to me. Yes. I would say that I would... The umbrella is works, significant works. Let me think. Works that are significant to our personal growth.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound good?
Yes.
Okay.
And we're each going to bring 5.
That is correct. So similar to our top 10s of big things. I think we're going to lean nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. Probably, but, although we might have a couple of novels.
Yeah, it's true. There. It's true. Yeah. I think, you know, the reason this came around, I can't remember the other thing that happened, but, you know, I feel like the United States is in like a weird topsy-turvy universe. And I think it's always good to consider how we can grow and learn as human beings. And as Socrates said, you know, the unexamined life is not worth living. So yeah, we're going to look at these novels that were impactful on us and our growth as humans.
All right. And you can catch that next time. Until then, send us some feedback. And we both, or I hope you, and I'm sure Stella does as well, hope you have a very happy, healthy, and safe holiday season. And we will see you in the new year.
Absolutely. And listen, just because you're getting freaky with a spirit does not mean you shouldn't wear protection. Okay.
Yeah, you don't know what weird
it's true
old-timey STI he's carrying.
They didn't have the body count talk or anything. Yeah.
Yeah, if there's some sort of pox or whatever. Anyway, all right, good night.
Scurvy.
Thanks for listening to Required Reading with Tom and Stella, which is brought to you by Two True Freaks. That's Two True Freaks. If you're interested in learning more about the books we've read or want to comment on the episode, follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/requiredreadingwithtomandstella.
If you would like to email us to comment on the episode or continue our discussion, you can reach us at requiredreadingcast@gmail.com. We will read every email we get on future episodes.
We're looking for more visibility, so if you liked this episode or the show in general, why not leave us a review in iTunes? Thanks again for listening, and come back next month for